Good evening, everyone. My name is Elwood Robinson, and I'm Chancellor at Winston-Salem State University and host of Future Focus Now. The critically acclaimed radio show Future Focus is back and better than ever. It's on a new platform created from a collaboration between our radio station, WSNC Public Radio 90.5 FM, our IT department, and our Division of Strategic Communication. This format was designed to enable us to provide you with important firsthand information from experts around the world. Please join us every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Except next week, we're going to be airing at 7:30 to have one of our guests on at that particular time. Our staff here at Future Focus Now is committed to bringing you the best conversations with some of this country's leading thought leaders, researchers, artists, personalities, about those issues that impact your life. But before we begin today, our conversation, we're gonna have a great conversation. I wanna take a moment to all of you out there to say thank you to all of those who are on the front line, to the nurses who provide care for those who need it most. And we wanna give a special shout out to one of our nurses from Winston-Salem State University, Shanna Alexander. And Shanna left us Winston-Salem about 2 weeks ago to go and work in Brooklyn, New York, to help out at the epicenter of the coronavirus. We're praying for you and thank you for all you do. For all the healthcare providers who support our hospitals, to all the drivers of the trucks who keep the supply lines going, to the grocery store workers, to all the parents and all the teachers providing support and resources for our children, to all the college and university professors and staff providing online learning for our students, many of you had never taught online before. The efforts of all these essential workers and many others that I have not even mentioned are critical to keeping our society functioning and making sure that everyone is safe, healthy, and have the resources that they need. Let me, from the bottom of my heart, say thank you to all of you who are doing that. We look forward for you joining us, those of you who are on Facebook Live and who are part of the program. Call a friend. Tell a friend that Future Focus Now is happening and you don't want to miss it. And we want you to stay with us throughout the hour, because this is going to be an exciting hour as we talk about some important issues around what's happening in our world today. So thank you for tuning in to Future Focus Now. Our first guest today and the first guest on our very first show is Dr. Melissa Witt-Glover. She's the Executive Director of the Center for Excellence in the Study of Health Disparities. She's an amazing individual that has been in the forefront of health disparities. She's an epidemiologist. She's a scientist. She is brilliant. She can tell us what we need to know about what's going on in America. Dr. Witt-Glover, thank you and welcome to Future Focus Now.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. How does it feel? You're the first guest on our new platform, and we're excited to have you. And I've been looking forward to this conversation since we put this in motion.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm glad to be your test case as a researcher. I'm always happy to be a part of somebody else's experiment. So
we're glad to have you part of the experiment. Well, one of the things that, you know, I want to start out in terms of this conversation that we're having today is I know that you've been in this space for a while, and you were a couple, three years ago, named the Executive Director for the Center for Excellence in the Elimination of Health Disparities. First of all, set the stage for us. Tell us what this center is. And I'd love for you to give us a little bit about the history of the center and some of the exciting work that's going on at Winston-Salem State in this particular center.
Sure. So I think the center started around 2002. I moved to Winston-Salem in 2003, and that's when I was first introduced to it. Dr. Sylvia Flack was the person who started it with a grant for the center from the National Institutes of Health. And over the past, beginning of the center, before I came here, there was a lot of work that was done to address disparities in health. There was funding that was provided for researchers, on campus, as well as some amazing community conferences to be able to provide information to the community. I think one of the years I came to the conference that was put on by Winston-Salem State Center, Sanjay Gupta was there. Year I came, Cornel West was there. And I was like, oh my goodness, what can I do to be a part of this center? They're doing amazing work. So I volunteered for a while and worked with Dr. Flack up until she retired. And when she retired, I asked if I could be engaged with the center, and Dean Peggy Valentine at the time, Dean Valentine, now interim chancellor at Fayetteville State, but she asked if I could be the interim director. And that's how it started 3 years ago, with me coming in to be helpful and then wanting to stay. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, and I think that's impressive. And you mentioned Dr. Sylvia Flack, but, you know, we talk about legends in healthcare. We talk about those who have done tremendous work. Dr. Flack and I first met almost 30 years ago, and we kind of bonded back then. We were in the second class of Leadership North Carolina together back in the early 90s. So I got a chance to know her and know of her work. And I think it's always interesting when you come and you follow someone like that. What was it like? And tell me a little bit about what you were thinking when you got into that role, knowing a little bit about the history of the center.
The thing that I thought most of all is, I hope I don't mess this up. Yes. Because she is a tiny woman, but she is powerful and she left some big shoes to fill. And I often talk to her and I say, Dr. Flack, this is what I'm doing. What do you think? And she always says, I'm proud of you. You keep moving forward. So It was exciting. One of the things that I remember most is when I first came here, I was at Wake Forest in the School of Medicine, and I was doing health disparities research, and we were doing things in the community. And I remember that when I started working and whenever we wanted to do a program in the community, they would say, check the calendars first, because if Winston-Salem State is having something, there's no point in us trying to do a community event. And I always thought, you know, the power that this university has to be able to bring together people from the community, particularly people of color who don't traditionally come out for things related to research, is probably untapped, because when Winston-Salem State University is doing something, whole sides of town stop. Yeah. And so I thought, I would love to be able to partner to figure out if there are ways that I can be helpful in some of the work that they're doing, because clearly you're a powerhouse in the community. So I've always wanted to be engaged with what was going on. But what was going through my head was, I don't want to disappoint Dr. Flack.
Right. Look, I know the feeling. I felt like that when I became chancellor here at Winston-Salem State. She actually called me before I took over my duties. So I was a little intimidated by getting a call from Dr. Flack coming in as chancellor here. So I understand the feeling. Tell me a little bit about the center. So how is it made up? Who works at the center? How is it constructed?
So we, because in a little bit, I'm going to talk to you about some of the projects we're doing. So I think it's important to know, the center right now is staffed by me as the executive director, and Rochelle Blakeney is our program coordinator. And then we take on undergraduate students who are interested in research to work with us. So we have anywhere from 10 to 15 students at a time who are interested in learning about research. And then the rest of what we do is faculty who are interested in volunteer, community partners who are interested in volunteering. But we manage to get things done with a lot of people who are passionate. And I think that's important, because if you are completely driven by money, when the money goes away, the program stops. But when you have a group of people who are driven by passion, who want to do the right thing and who want to be helpful and who want to make improvements, that work is going to continue, and you'll figure out how to get it done regardless of the resources that you have available. So we've been able to do a lot of work with a small but committed group of people.
Yeah. And how would you, if I asked you, how is the center perceived in the Winston-Salem community and in the triad and so forth? What's your sense of what people, how people see the center?
I think we are growing. I think people perceive that the center is hundreds of people, because we get lots of calls from people wanting us to help with things. And I don't think they realize how small our group is. But
Small but mighty.
Yes. But I would say that we are definitely respected in terms of what we can do to help with disparities in health and health education in the community. Many of our community partners reach out to us when they want to do work related to health education in the community. And so I think we're respected, and I think our reputation is continuing to grow. And what we're working on now is expanding our reputation outside of Winston-Salem, because what we're doing is powerful, and we believe that we can be a model for other areas outside of Winston-Salem. And so that's what we're setting ourselves up for.
Great, fantastic. And a little bit later, we'll get into some of the work that you're doing. And I think you're really setting the stage, and you're a model, I think, center, and some of the work that's really coming out of it. And we'll get into that in just a moment. But as we look at the notion of the Center for Excellence in the study of health, in the elimination of health disparities, why excellent? Why did that become a part of it?
So interestingly, the very first grant that was used to start the center, they were all four centers of excellence. And so there are many centers that are named that. And the whole reason that people got funding was you had to submit proposals that showed that you were going to be able to create models that were effective and sustainable, and that could make a difference. And so the fact that Dr. Flack and the team at Winston-Salem State was able to put together a proposal that showed that we could create something that would make us an excellent organization as it relates to health disparities, I think is powerful, because many organizations, many academic institutions applied for that funding. Many applied, few were chosen. We were one of the few that was chosen. So that speaks to, and when you submit those grants, you know, you get reviewed by your peers. And so other people had to review what Winston-Salem State had to offer, and they agreed that, yes, this would be a center of excellence. And so,
Early on, did you follow the work that was coming out of the center? I know you know you were Wake Forest. I know you got your degree from UNC in terms of epidemiology. You didn't get your epidemiology degree from there, but you got a degree from UNC Chapel Hill. Did you, at the time when you were going through that, were you aware of some of the things that were happening at the center?
I wasn't. So when I was at UNC Chapel Hill, my degree was exercise science, and I didn't even know anything about health disparities or any of that until I did my public health degree. And so I did my public health degree at the University of South Carolina, and we were really studying how to measure things, but not really what to do about it. So I didn't even learn anything about health disparities until I worked with another researcher. Her name is Dr. Shiriki Kumanyika up at the University of Pennsylvania. And she is the one who really got me interested in an understanding that not only can we measure differences in health, but we can do something about it. And that's when I started looking at the fact that there are centers that do this kind of work. And my first center of excellence that I worked at was at the University of Pennsylvania. We had a center of excellence. It was when they very first started these, and we partnered with Cheney University, and we were doing some work up in that area. And so that's how it started. And that's how I began to realize that there were these kinds of centers. And I think in the early 2000s, we were kind of one of the first institutions that got this funding. So I don't know that these centers of excellence really were in existence very much before that time.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, you're in graduate school, and now you're an epidemiologist, and you were not connected to that. How did it come about that you started working with this researcher?
So I was working with a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, and her research was looking at the best ways to measure physical activity. And we were collecting information on that, and we were also measuring things like blood pressure and blood sugar. And we were seeing that there were connections between if you were exercising more, your blood pressure was lower. If you're exercising less, your blood pressure was higher. But our research really was focused on what's the best ways to measure physical activity in different populations. So different people might have different types of exercise that resonate with them, so you can't ask the same questions. Well, I started connecting dots, because when I was going out and measuring physical activity in the Black community, and then I would measure blood pressure, I would say, well, this is interesting. Their blood pressure's high, and they're saying they're not doing any physical activity. there's a connection here. And my advisor said, you're absolutely right. And there are these things called interventions, which I didn't know anything about that. And so she said, I suggest you do some reading. And so I started reading research articles and I came across this name of my postdoc advisor, Shariki Kumuniga. And my doctoral advisor, Barbara Ainsworth, I will say she was very instrumental in that. She always made sure, as a faculty member, she made sure that as students, we went to conferences. And when we went to conferences, she made us make a list of who we wanted to meet in terms of researchers. And she introduced us and she made us talk to them. And that's how I met my postdoc advisor at a conference. And so I say that because, yes, you know, I appreciated at the beginning of the show when you were thanking the faculty, the influence that faculty have on people's trajectories, I don't think we have any idea. I knew nothing about any of this until I met this woman at a conference. And I only met her because my advisor had a rule that we had to go to conferences and we had to meet people. We couldn't sit in our rooms.
That's absolutely incredible. Yeah. And that's amazing. And you have continued to do that at Winston-Salem State.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we try to do here is we talk about getting students involved in high impact practices, undergraduate research, being able to attend conferences in the whole nine yards.
Yes.
If we get students in that space, they're going to turn out like you.
And when we send students, our students do amazing. And I think you were, I think at the UNC Student Success Conference, one of the Center of Excellence students, Diamond Bynum, went and presented and did an amazing job. And because of that, met a faculty member at East Carolina and is now in graduate school there. I mean, you have to make these connections, but we have to help our students make these connections. And we can't forget that somebody helped us.
Absolutely. Fantastic. That's great. Thank you for that background. Take us now back to the center. What's going on at the center? What kind of research is currently being done?
What is not being done? So I'll give you just a couple of examples because we have a lot that's going on. One thing we're doing right now is there's a program that was started by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called the Diabetes Prevention Program, which we know works to prevent people from developing diabetes. But what we cannot figure out is how to get more people who are at risk, and particularly communities of color, to participate in the programs. So one of the strategies is to fund state health departments to bring the programs into communities. Forsyth County Health Department has one of the grants, but they had often talked to me about the fact that they didn't necessarily always have enough community health workers to go into the communities and teach the program. And community health workers are people who are in the community, who are like people in the community. They're not necessarily health professionals, but they are trained to be able to talk to people and lead people through a program. So we got a grant from the National Institutes of Health to create a course to train our students to be community health workers. So we have trained to date, we've had nearly 100 students go through that course.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and so it's a 2-year grant. So nearly 100 students have gone through that course. We're ending the grant now, but it's a powerful model that again shows how we can do a good job in addressing disparities, because when you have people that look like the community that are out delivering the care, it's a different kind of exchange in terms of how people are treated, in terms of the quality of treatment, in terms of how that's received. And so our goal in that project is to train as many people as we can to be able to go out and deliver health information in the community. And so that's one of our projects that's been amazing.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great. I mean, how can a student, if you're a student at Winston-Salem State University or any one of the surrounding colleges and universities, how do you become a part of this?
So right now, that class continues to be offered in the fall and the spring. Dr. Haley Figueroa and I co-teach that class, and it's a general education class that any of the students can sign up for.
I mean, she's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So students can sign up for that class. It's in healthcare management and or exercise science. It's cross-listed. But again, I mentioned that we want Winston-Salem State to be a model. So what we built into this grant is a way to partner with other HBCUs to say, how can you do this at your university? And so right now we're working with Virginia State University and Norfolk State University. We have two two consultants, Sheila Ward, and then one person who you used to be his dean, Oliver Jenkins.
Yes.
They are consultants, and we are actually creating a certificate program where it will be a post-baccalaureate certificate program, and then other HBCUs can offer similar program. That's another part of our project. So anytime we do projects, we do them with an eye toward how can we serve as a model for other HBCUs and other areas in the country to be able to do this work.
Great, fantastic, expanding, growing. Yeah. That's a great project. What other things are you doing?
So we have a partnership right now with Novant Health. One of the things we know about health disparities is that there can sometimes be unconscious biases or things that care providers might have in their minds or that people might have in their minds that might influence how care is given or received. And unconscious bias is one of those things. So if I have a perception about you when you walk in as my doctor, that might determine whether or not I want you to give me care. If you have a perception about me and I walk in to provide you with care, you might not want to receive care from me. So we're working with Novant Health and we are creating a series of five vignettes, kind of mini plays with Garrett Davis from G. Davis Productions. And we are creating an educational program for healthcare providers to address unconscious bias. And it's gonna be for healthcare providers. And we're also hoping that it will be able to be used for people who are in training. And we are in the midst of doing that project right now. We have the vignettes created, we're creating a workbook, and we have just found out from Novant that we should be able to use this as an opportunity to provide continuing education credits for care providers. And so this then becomes a program where Winston-Salem State University is being able to go out and teach the community as well as teach our students how to deliver the best care and to manage your biases. We know we all have biases, but how can you manage those biases and make sure that that does not impact how you provide care to people? So that's another exciting thing we have happening.
I think it's extremely exciting when you think about that, because what I like is that you have a number of different kind of entities involved in this. You've got mm-hmm. healthcare. And did you say you're creating plays?
Yeah, they're vignettes. So they are five scenarios. And with each scenario, you'll get to see a piece of the story. And then you have discussion questions that you can answer after to help. So what would you do in this situation? What do you think should be done? And it starts out with a care provider coming into a room and the person who's receiving care has a reaction to that provider. Because these are things that we know from our students and from our faculty members, we know these are things that happen when people go out into the field. And so we want our students and we want care providers to be prepared. How do you handle it? Okay. What happens if someone doesn't want to get care?
I'm curious in terms of how you do the vignettes. Do you have actors or people acting it out? Do you videotape that and show the videotape? And how do you use that for training?
So again, using our model format, we're going to start out with it being live so that we can get feedback from the local community around whether or not this resonates. And then we'll commit them to film so that then it becomes a video series with a workbook that other people can use to train. So we're working with Garrett Davis, and he's done a couple things on our campus over the last couple of years doing what we call edutainment, where he teaches people, but through plays. And so he's the one that's writing the vignettes for us. But right now we're going to do some table reads with folks since we're going to do live acting, but we're being creative and we'll do some table reads over Zoom to get some feedback from some folks who might be end users of this. Once we get them solidified and we say, okay, this is the right content to be able to train people, then we'll film them and then other people across the United States can use them. And again, we want Winston-Salem State to be the model that people look to say, this is a good example of what should be done and let's figure out how we can do it here.
Yeah, take us through one more exciting thing you do. And then I want to get into the mobile RAMS know-how unit and let you talk about that for a little bit. Tell me something else that you is going
so on. So one more exciting thing, and you were there for it. We won a $100,000 prize from a grant from the American Heart Association to address inequities in food access. So we are working with a local urban farmer, Michael Banner, who is a part of Island Cultures. He's lead of Island Cultures. And we're working to address poverty and f- food access. And so Michael is an urban farmer, and he's got some gardens within the eastern part of Winston-Salem. And so we're working with them to be able to get the gardens planted and to figure out how we can create some business models around that so it becomes sustainable and it becomes an opportunity not only to provide food, but also to provide jobs for people. And so on that side of town, we have the urban farms with Michael Banner. On the other side of town, with the Enterprise Center, which is attached to Winston-Salem State University, we have community gardens where people can rent their own garden plots if they want to grow their own gardens. Tiffany Williams, who is a Winston-Salem State alum and a Black girl beekeeper, has put some beehives back there.
So wait, say that again.
Yes, Black girl beekeeper, Tiffany Williams.
Black girl beekeeper.
Beekeeper, yes. So she, I don't know if this is the right terminology, but raises bees, and then she produces the honey and the wax and all the products that goes along with it. So she's got some beehives in the garden. We can rent garden space. We can provide education. So now that's an opportunity to provide education. It's an opportunity to provide products that can be sold, that can be fed back to keep the garden going. And it's an opportunity to provide jobs. So again, trying to figure out how can we address food access issues, but also address issues of poverty so that we don't, you know, we don't just want to give things away. We also want people to be able to do things on their own. So with Michael Banner and his group, the idea is to be able to grow enough produce that we'll be able to have farmers markets, we'll be able to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And then that ties back to our diabetes prevention program, because now we have access. Now we have students that can come in with the program to teach, what do you do with all these fresh fruits and vegetables? How do you use those to maintain your health? So yes, it all ties together.
Yeah, you got all these things going on, and you got all these things going on because we have these things called food deserts.
Yes.
What is that? I mean, just explain that to our viewers and our listeners.
Yeah. So there's really two terms. So one is food deserts, which is food deserts is really an absence of opportunities to get access to foods. So it may be more like in rural communities where there are not stores available, where it's very far to get to stores. But then you also have things called food swamps. So food swamps are places where food is available, but it's all unhealthy food. So it's places where you might not have a lot of access to fresh fruits and vegetables, but you can always find fast food restaurants that sell unhealthy food. So they're called food swamps because you could get 5 hamburgers for $1, or you can get 1 apple for $1. What are people going to do?
Now that's a new one on me. Yes. I had not heard of food swamps.
Yeah.
But it makes sense.
Yeah.
And so if we think about all the work that you just mentioned, it really is about going into those communities and help providing healthy food and access to food.
Providing healthy food and access to food, but really importantly, what we aim to do, sometimes we miss, but what we aim to do is working with the community. And so just as an example, the Urban Farm Project, the reason we wrote that grant proposal is because Michael Banner from the community approached us and asked us to work with him. And I think it's important because a lot of times as researchers, we try to fly into communities and solve people's problems as opposed to working with communities and seeing how we can be helpful, because many times communities are already doing things and they may need help or they may need us to get out of the way and support in other ways. So,
that's a great point. I think one of the things when we talk about doing research in communities of colors and African-American communities, we know, for example, there's a great deal of distrust around that. And Absolutely. So having to build and work in those communities and build trust in those communities is a central part of how a researcher would do community research, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And when you work with communities, you're creating sustainable models, because a lot of times we come in with our research project and the research study is over and the funding's over. Now nobody can continue anything because you were the one that came with all the resources. So I think, you know, being hand in hand means that it's going to continue long after you're gone, which is what we should want as researchers, right?
Sure. Yeah. Let's move into one of the things that differentiates, I think, Winston-Salem State from a lot of folks is what we do with our mobile clinic.
Yes.
So tell me about the mobile clinic.
So the Ramsdale Hall Mobile Clinic, and I have to give a shout out to Michael Alexander. He is our driver, without whom we would not be able to move our mobile clinic. We could look at it, but we couldn't drive it. So thank you, Mr. Alexander. But the Ramsdale Hall Mobile Clinic started out being able to provide screenings for people to be able to let them know if they had high blood pressure or hypertension or high cholesterol. We recently partnered with the United Health Centers, and so we have in fact become a rolling doctor's office. And so we have Emily McNair from United Health Centers and Alexia Friend actually come on the mobile unit. They are a physician assistant and a nurse, and they actually can do everything that you could do when you, if you walked into your doctor's office for an appointment, you know, no x-rays or anything like that. But if you walked into an urgent care or you walked into a doctor's office and you need an appointment, you can get all that done right on the mobile clinic. And the idea is that we want to be able to drive into communities where there's not access to healthcare, where transportation might be an issue, to try to remove the barriers. Because we tell people to make the right decisions or to make certain decisions about their health, but then we don't give people an opportunity to make those decisions. So if you say you should get regular checkups, but there's not transportation or access, then how can people really make that decision? So we try to remove as many barriers as we can.
Yeah, and how have you impacted the community with the mobile clinic?
So we've seen on average, I think the mobile clinic was given to us by Novant Health, I think somewhere in the mid 2000s, it was before I got here. I think on average, we were seeing about 1,000 to 1,500 people annually to do screenings. So we go out to health fairs and we do things like that. And so we're able to improve or increase people's knowledge and awareness of their chronic disease. We're able to do checks for people that maybe have diabetes and they want to come and make sure their blood sugar is okay. We can do those kinds of things. And so we're able to impact that way. I think now what we're seeing is we're ramping up our services in terms of providing medical care, thanks to a generous grant from the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust, we are able to begin to see a difference in terms of people who are accessing care. One of the things we have learned is that people are coming to the mobile unit a lot. And so now we're working on getting an electronic record system so we can track people, because it turns out people might begin to start to use the mobile clinic as their medical, as their preferred medical home. So we need to be ready for that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And so to date, or today, in this year, for example, or last year, how many screenings did you do?
I knew you were going to ask me that question. I unfortunately do not have. I'm going to say, because we probably do about 50 or so a month on average, at least. So I would guess that, you know, one of the challenges with this particular calendar year is we tend to be slower in the cold, in the winter months. And then as soon as it started warming up, at the time that we would ramp up, you know, everything shut down with COVID-19. So we haven't seen as many. What the mobile unit is doing right now, though, is for the last 2 weeks, we have actually been working with Novant Health. We asked if we could be helpful in terms of addressing COVID-19. So we're at one of the Novant Health clinics, and we serve as an outpost for people that are coming in and getting the drive up testing. They are able to use the mobile unit as their staging area. So We're ramping up and doing a lot. I just talked to the mobile unit driver, and he said it's been extremely busy for the last couple of days, which is good because we've got a mobile unit and we definitely want it to be out providing service in the community.
Fantastic. And that's great. It's one of the things that I'm most proud of at Winston-Salem State University is the mobile clinic and the work that you guys are doing, which is extraordinary. And I hope you win a number of awards around that work, because it's so much needed. Yeah. Let's segue, given the fact you talked about COVID-19, and here we are, and the reason why we created this platform, and the reason why you and I are not together, you're in your home and I'm in my home, is because we're right in the middle of a pandemic, and we hear that all the time. And explain, as an epidemiologist, explain to our viewers and our listeners what a pandemic is.
So I would say a pandemic, just kind of in the easiest terms, is a disease that's widespread, that is continuing to spread. We can't necessarily get a hold of it right now. More and more people are developing it, and there's not a known cure at this point. And so we're still trying to figure out how to handle it. What are the best ways to address it to at least slow it down?
Yeah. And so what's happening at this moment in time? I mean, we've been through a period where we've been sheltering in place by the governor and mayors across the country. And in fact, I wrote this weekend in my journal that it had been 40 days. And then I thought about this, you know, 40 days and 40 nights. There's something, you know, kind of biblical about 40 days and 40 nights when I was writing over the weekend. So we've been sheltering in place because of that. What are we trying to do?
We're trying to, what they call, flatten the curve. We're trying to get, trying to keep everybody who's not sick from getting sick while we treat all the people who are sick so we can eliminate the virus. The problem is we say that we want people to shelter in place, but then there's a segment of people that still have to keep going out. And so it's, and then there's a segment of people because some people are continuing to go out and they can't figure out why some people can go out, but they can't go out. We can't get everybody to stop going out. So even though there is an order to shelter in place, we're not doing probably as good of a job as the health field would like us to be doing to slow this down as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think about and I look at and I hear people talking all the time about, you know, this is, you know, unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this before. I wrote again this weekend. I don't think that it is. I mean, we've been through challenges before. We've been through pandemics. We've been through health crises. We've been through some significant kind of health care management issues in this country since we've been a country.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily see it as unprecedented, but if people keep talking about that.
It seems like it's unprecedented because it's moving so quickly. Every day I read something new, and I'm not an infectious disease epidemiologist, but every day I read a new symptom that they just found or a new way it can be transmitted or something that we thought was true in terms of how it could be transmitted and who could get it. Now we find out that there's even more, that that's not necessarily true. And sometimes I wonder if that's why they're calling it unprecedented, because today it just doesn't seem like we can get our arms around this thing.
Yeah, just in terms of the symptoms, who it impacts and how it impacts it, it changes every day. I agree with you. Now we're talking about how it might impact the cardiovascular system that we hadn't really kind of thought about before. And that's kind of a new symptom that comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we look at this, tell me how, as an epidemiologist, what you have learned about this particular COVID-19. Has this changed your perspective at all about epidemiology and diseases?
So I'm more of a chronic disease epidemiologist than an infectious disease epidemiologist. One of the things I think is interesting is it has changed the public's perspective of epidemiology. I think more people know what it is now. More people know that it's not the study of skin, which is what everybody thought I did because of epidermis. But so in terms of, I think for me, what I find surprising is just the major impact, even more so than other health issues, the major impact that it seems to be having on communities of color and poor communities, but also how surprised people are about that. I think I find that interesting. So what it says to me from the perspective of public health and from the perspective of someone who studies disparities is that we must not be doing, we're not doing a very good job of helping people understand the factors that cause disparities because so many people are so surprised. And I've been studying disparities for a long time and thought that, you know, well, this is, I'm sure people are sick of hearing about this. The number of people who are just like, oh my goodness, like why are there these differences in health has been really surprising to me. And it probably shouldn't be surprising, but it is.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, when I think about what I've learned and what was surprising to me is as this process went along, and we began to see there were extreme disparities in people of color, African American communities. It almost seemed to me as if people were just finding out about health disparities in this country, and that's something that we've known. You and I have known, you know, for me a little bit longer than you probably, but in terms of looking at health disparities. I was doing this work, you know, back in the 80s, back in the 90s. you know, I was writing papers about the social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote, my research team, we created the first instrument to measure racism, because we were exploring the whole notion of racism as a social determinant of health outcomes.
Right.
And I look back today just to remind myself that paper was published in 1996, and that work has been going on for a long time. So now people are now saying about health disparities. So I have a huge question for you. And my question to you, for you, is why are there in this country, why is there in this country health inequities?
Well, so we know that there are policies and systems and environment that systematically set people up to not have the same advantages or the same options as other people have. And so those kinds of differences, they start early on and they continue throughout a person's life. And then it drives everything that a person can do in terms of being able to make decisions to take care of their health. Some of it, a lot of it really is rooted in racism and people just saying racism or isms in general and saying, I don't think that certain groups should have the same advantages or the same opportunities as other groups. And when you decide to make policies or rules like that, then that means people are going to have a hard time being able to take care of their health and make the decisions to take care of their health. But it also means that those isms cause, I talked about this before, those isms cause biases. And when you think about differences in health as it relates to even the quality of care and the types of care that people get, if you have isms or biases in the back of your mind, that's going to influence how you treat people when they come in for care. It's going to influence the types of advice that you provide people. It's going to influence lots of things. And that then impacts their health down the road.
Yeah. Were you as surprised as I was about, you know, this really kind of almost kind of people feeling for the first time that there is such a thing as health disparities in this country, as we look at how this disease has disproportionately impacted really African Americans, but also persons of color? And I see this as an opportunity to elevate the discussion around the importance of and significance of the kind of work that you do, mm-hmm. and the kind of work that people do in the area of health disparities. How can we, because once again, I started this conversation 5 minutes ago by saying we've been in this space for a long time, mm-hmm. but we continue to go through these cycles in which people, we can't seemingly sustain it from a research standpoint or sustain it in the minds of researchers going forward.
Yeah, I don't know how we'll be able to sustain it. One of the things I find interesting, and this seems like a really good opportunity for us to drive home these points, is the number of people who were seemingly, I'm not sure the right way to say it, but people of means, people who weren't impacted by disparities, but now are having to shelter at home and are realizing things aren't as easy as they thought they were.
Yeah, the whole and concept so now building it together, right?
Right. So now people are getting a glimpse. So even people who are, say, CEOs in organizations, but now they're having to shelter at home, and maybe they live in an area where the internet is spotty, and now they're realizing, wait, I can't just get online and do X, Y, and Z. Oh, now I understand how my clients must feel. Now I understand how other people must feel. Or I'm trying to work from home and my children keep coming in and out of the room and I can't find a quiet space and it's impacting my mental health. Oh, now I understand how people might feel if they live in crowded housing conditions where they can't, you know. And so I wonder if, and it's just even it's a glimpse, it's not even like a full-fledged, this is exactly it, because they're going to come out of this situation at some point. But maybe this is now the time to get those people to start addressing policies, systems, and environments, because now they are impacted as well. The fact that, you know, I've seen a lot of teachers, particularly in public school settings. I saw at the beginning when this first started, teachers were sending home lots of work, and then some of those teachers were at home with their own kids. And then they started to realize, wait a minute, I'm given five different websites to go to. This is actually harder than I thought it was. And when you're on the other side, it's like, wait a second, let's figure out how to do this better. And so I think this is an opportunity for those of us who are doing this work, but we've got to figure out how to move quickly, right? Because people's memories, I think, are short. So when everything goes back, people are going to quickly forget how difficult this was.
I mean, great, great point. How optimistic are you that it will change things?
So I work with another partner in some other work that I do, and we're working with grantees from several organizations around the country that are focusing on health work with children. And this is the point where we're trying to really help them to figure out how to change their policies and systems and their practices. And so if we can get them to make some level changes, that's a bunch of organizations. I also work with Mecklenburg County Health Department with some work that I'm doing around with churches. They are now figuring out some different ways of doing things and behaving that I think will be sustainable as we come out of this. So I'm optimistic that people will at least, now we are having to think outside the box. This is forcing people to think outside the box to come up with creative strategies to address things. I'm optimistic that maybe some of those strategies will be able to stick. But I'm also optimistic, I'm cautiously optimistic that people who are impacted by disparities now are starting to see that people didn't get it, and maybe we will be able to collectively continue to band together to push for change and to continue to push for change, to continue to ask for change. So think about the fact that up until, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, they weren't even reporting COVID data using race ethnicity. And so we just knew that there were COVID cases, but we didn't even know about the disparities. And because people were pushing and saying, we have to know how this is being impacted, there was an act that was just signed to push to get data reported by race ethnicity. Those are the kinds of things that if we can keep pushing collectively, we may be able to make a difference and make changes that are going to last. But we can't forget.
Yeah.
We can't forget. That's the thing. We who are being affected, and we, whether or not we're being affected or not, we who are part of the community, whether we're affected directly or indirectly, we have to remember this, because we have to continue to speak for people who might not be able to have this voice or this platform later.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. And well said. I mean, that was really well said. As we think about so-called reopening, and so one of the things that we talk about is one of the metrics that is being used is there's been a decline in the number of cases over a 14-day period, right? And so as you see that decline, and you say, well, I think it's about time to open up. Here's what I worry about when we talk about health disparities and health inequities. I worry indeed what communities are we looking at when we make that determination? It is, in fact, there are some communities in which we see that, and other communities in which might not be there, and those may be the ones that are being left out. Those particular communities of color, under-resourced communities, African Americans. I wonder if, in fact, we're taking that into consideration.
I don't know that we are, and I worry about some of the things I see on the news where you see leaders offering up our communities as the pilot test or the guinea pig to see if, in fact, it is okay. There was a news story. Anderson Cooper interviewed the mayor of Las Vegas. I don't know if you saw that of days ago. And she said, I offered us to be the placebo, and I was told that I couldn't do that. But she wanted them to open up the casinos and the hotels. Well, who was working? Who were the people that would be most affected? So I worry on one hand that we might open up and we might be looking at whether or not cases are cleared up in certain segments of the community and not focusing on those that are most at risk. I also worry that we might open up things like in Georgia, where the communities that are most at risk would be sent out first to see if it's okay.
Yeah. And for example, and you're right. I mean, if we look at those who are most affected, by COVID-19 are the frontline workers. And who are the frontline workers? And now we're beginning to get a profile of what the frontline workers are like. And now we're seeing that we need to pay more attention to those communities because oftentimes those are the most vulnerable communities.
When you say, and we say frontline workers, and when we say frontline workers, people automatically think, well, the doctors and the nurses. Yes. But if you change that to say essential employees are the housekeepers. They are the cooks. They are the people that are working in the meat manufacturing plants. There was just another story right before I came on, 50 people in, I think it was Wilkesboro, in one of the, I think it was one of the Tyson plants are affected by COVID, tested positive for COVID-19. Those are the people, you know, when we say, like earlier we said, we've been effectively sheltering at home. None of those people have been able to shelter at home. They just keep getting sent out. There was just a strawberry farm where a good number of the employees, many of them were Hispanic, Latino. They were wearing masks and gloves, but people wanted their strawberries. And so they had to keep coming to work. And you know what happened? The farm is now shut down because the workers got sick. Yeah. So those are, we say frontline, and I think we might need to reframe it and talk about essential employees. The people, we keep going to the grocery store. We might only go once a week, but you know what? They have to come every day.
Right. You know, I like that in terms of, and I like that perspective. Do you think that we would start thinking differently about these essential workers? What do you think?
Again, I think that those of us who look like the essential workers, whether we are the essential workers or not, and those of us who care about those groups are going to have to help to remember to, we're going to have to keep pushing to be that voice. Yeah. Because I think people's memories are short, and it's unfortunate, but I think we have to keep pushing and remembering that we have to think, even, you know, I see these jokes on social media now. Not only do we have to think about the essential workers, but all the people that we rely on now that we didn't really think about, like teachers. You know, we thought teachers didn't really do a whole lot until we had to homeschool our kids. And now we're like, when is Teacher Appreciation Day again? So we've got to be able to think about that and appreciate, celebrate those folks, and also fight for things like fair wages. Because one of the reasons, you know, fair wages and fair practices, a lot of our essential workers are forced to go to work because they don't have paid time off. They don't have health insurance. They don't have a lot of the things that we take for granted. And so we, not only can we not forget, but we have to make sure that we are fighting for things that maybe don't affect us directly, but that affect the people that affect us. Right now, everybody's scared to eat chicken because all the Tyson plant people are getting sick.
No,
but
no.
I bet you didn't think about those people before.
Glover, is this new? What is this about chicken?
Yeah, the poultry workers in the chicken plants are testing positive for COVID-19. So now people are saying, well, I don't know. But see, nobody thought about any of those people before COVID-19. And now it's like, wait a minute, those packages of food didn't just show up in the store magically.
I thought about that. I was just kidding about the chicken. But, you know, I agree with you. And what I hope is that we do have a deeper appreciation for every person. You know, I like to think how the world works. Yeah. Everybody's important.
Everybody
needs to be rewarded for that. And we will think differently in terms of how we support our workforce. I know you were talking about, social media. Shonda Rhimes, I think, had posted that she thought teachers should be making $1 million a year. She said maybe $1 billion, you know, after having to homeschool, you know, her kids.
Yes, I have two. I have a 12 and 13 year old, and I had to close the door. I had to send my 13 year old out today and close the door and take a few deep breaths because he's got a project doing. I was fussing. I was like, how are we supposed to do all this? And I stopped and I said, oh, wait a second. But it's hard.
No, I understand. I understand clearly. My daughter has a 5-year-old and she has a 10-month-old, and she talks to me all the time telling me to come get the kids. Come get them. You know,
bless
come get
her.
Them. You know, and so it is very difficult. It's a difficult time for a lot of people. And hopefully, you know, we can support teachers better, you know, kind of because of this going forward.
Yeah.
We don't have much time left. You've been great, but tell me what's next for you. I mean, what's on the horizon for Dr. Whit Glover? What are some things you're thinking about for the center and the kinds of research projects you'd like to get into?
So one of the main things that we're working on for the center is we would love to have more opportunities for students to be engaged in research and for faculty to be engaged in research. So we're applying for another major center grant through National Institutes of Health to support our work. We'd like to be able to do more partnerships, build more partnerships within the community. And so that's our main focus right now, really is wrapping up some of the things we're working on, but also trying to get another major grant that will support what we're doing to continue to allow us to work in the community.
Yeah, and how has COVID-19 impacted your ability to conduct research?
We have had to think outside the box, but I tell you, it's made us think more creatively. So we have, I think, 10 students right now that work with the center, and we have 5 social work interns. And so we've been able to work creatively with them, but it's caused us, I think, to think outside the box, to be a little bit more organized and deliberate. We're working on 2 publications right now. One of the things that we should be releasing next month is a COVID-19 response specifically for college students. We realize nobody's talking to college students. And so again, we want Winston-Salem State to be that model. So we've got some students that are working with us to do that, but it's caused us to really have to think creatively to be able to figure out how we're gonna get this work done.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah. Take us out in terms of, I know you say you're optimistic. What's on the other side of COVID-19?
What's on the other side of COVID-19, what I would like to say is more engagement of the community. And I would like to say the community members as well as community organizations in terms of really trying to figure out how to address and fix some of the social determinants of health. So what we're focusing on is in terms of next steps is how can we make sure we don't go back here? So what kinds of things do we need to do? So where do we need to advocate? So we've seen where the holes are, and we've seen where some of the weaknesses, where some of the gaps are. And so now what we are focusing on is how can we rally the folks in the community and, as well as researchers and other community partners and figure out how we can get the resources that we need so that if this happens again, because there's probably going to be a resurgence, we aren't caught like this again.
Yeah. Give us your best commercial going out for the center.
Oh my goodness. And I have a 0 marketing sense. My best commercial going out for the center, Winston-Salem State University Center of Excellence for the Elimination of Health Disparities is a model. We hope to be a model for the rest of the United States, and we invite all of the citizens, all of the faculty at Winston-Salem State University, and all of the citizens of Winston-Salem Forsyth County to join us in our quest to remain excellent.
Bam, drop the mic. You did a great job. Thank you. Thank you for joining me tonight. Thank you for being my very first guest on Future Focus Now. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation. It's been informative. And I continue to be a big fan. So keep doing what you're doing. And hopefully we will be back together real soon.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you everybody for joining us tonight. We'll be back next week with another Future Focus Now with great guests. Our first 5 guests are really incredible, and you don't want to miss a moment of any of them. So join us next week on Future Focus Now. Good night, everybody.